And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's Gear Focus Podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Jonathan Wall, Golf's Managing Editor for Equipment, joined, as always, by my brother in gear, Senior Equipment Editor, Andrew Tursky. Tursky, what's going on, man?
That was a great intro, Jay Wall. Very well done.
I try, as everybody can tell. The professor is not with us again this week for the podcast. Prayers go out to him and to his family, as they're still going through some difficult times right now. But hopefully we'll get him back here in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely.
So, what'd you think of that clinic that the Mr. DJ, or should I call Mr. 30 Under, put on last week?
30 is so crazy. Like, it's not just, you know, one of those offshoot tournaments. It's a playoff event at a real course.
I couldn't do it in a video game. He was one over on his front nine on Thursday, and the dude still shot 30 under.
Yeah, it's like Tiger at the Masters in 97. Goes out in 40, comes back in 30, and then just blitzes the field the rest of the way. Honestly, incredible. It's such a typical DJ thing. Like, he didn't choke at the PGA, but, you know, he lost it. And then he just comes out, torches the field. He just makes all the birdies. He birdied like every hole.
It was the closest thing I've seen to a video game round. I joked on social media. I said I actually shot 27 one time at TPC Boston on Tiger Woods PGA Tour 2008. So I knew exactly how DJ was feeling when he was lapping the field. But yeah, unbelievable performance from him. As usual, Tursky, we got a lot to get into this week. We'll discuss Scottie Scheffler's bag setup and why I have now called him the equipment unicorn. Bubba Watson switched putters, went back to an old friend, and I want us to discuss if we've added any old friends to the bag recently. Ping has a new G4 25 driver on the USGA conforming list. You know, there's some things we can talk about because we don't know all the details, but we got to get into the new driver. Got a mailbag question, and with Phil's win in his first Champions Tour start, there is nobody better to talk to about his gear than Garrett Pond. He's Callaway's senior club performance analyst, and he's going to be joining us for this week's interview. All right, Tursky, let's get into it, man.
Where are we starting? Scottie Scheff with the pot?
Scottie Scheff, Mr. 59 himself, you know, and I think that's the main reason why we're going to talk about Scottie Scheffler is the guy's been on. I hate using the word heater because the word heater to me would be a guy who's actually won and been playing really well. Scottie's been playing well. He hasn't won.
Throwing shots. Man. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay, Jay Wall. I see what energy we're on today. I like it.
Yeah, I'm bringing that energy. But let's kind of figure out this setup, man. This is, you look, you and I have been out on tour a lot over the years.
Yep.
We've seen what's in guys' bags. I would dare say that Scottie Scheffler is the only guy I've ever seen who has seven different brands represented in the bag.
Seven's aggressive. I love to see seven. I mean, Tommy Fleetwood's probably been close. Patrick Reed has probably been close, but you just got to respect Scottie Scheff going with seven different brands, half the bag, not matching. It's great. You just love to see it. You know, I like to go with different brands throughout my bag too. So nothing but respect for this. He's got some old stuff in there too.
Gearhead. Yeah. I was about to say, we got to talk about what is in the bag. Cause he, in my opinion, is a true gearhead. He starts off with a Ping G400 LST, goes right into, I would say maybe my favorite club in his bag, Nike VR Pro Limited 3-wood. This is a 3-wood that was released back in 2011. So it's a decade old, but Scottie said that the new ones today just go too far and he likes the clean crown on it. And the distance that it goes is reliable. So he's kept it in the bag for a decade. That there, you know, we've talked about that a little bit. He might have one of the oldest clubs on tour, a decade old.
Yeah, I was gonna say definitely the oldest fairway wood, right? I think Charles Schwartzel had a pretty old one for a while, but
Stenson with the Diablo Octane.
Yeah, that's out though.
Well, it depends on the week.
That's true.
It's never officially out of the bag. You know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he goes from there into the Srixon Z-U85 utility iron. He's got a Z-785 Srixon 4-iron, TaylorMade P730 in the 5-through pitch, Callaway MD4 in a 50 and a 55 degree, Artisan Golf, shout out Mike Taylor, in the 60 degree, Scotty Cameron Tour Wrap putter in a Pro V1 golf ball. That makes a beautiful 7. Right there for Scottie Scheffler.
I love the combo iron set with two different brands, not just two different styles of design, not a cavity back and a blade, two different brands. Man, goals right there.
It's such a great setup. You know, people I think would go, man, this guy has to be a total gearhead. He's probably looking at his numbers really closely. I mean, Scotty's not that kind of guy. You know, he plays what he likes. It was funny. There was a video that I saw that was posted with him doing a what's in the bag, and he turned his Scotty Cameron putter over and he goes, "Oh, it's called a tour rat." Okay, yeah, I don't know why. I mean, he's literally like he's that guy. It works. It's been that way for a while, and he's just not going to switch. I mean, if you look at his gear in his bag, it's not new stuff. P730, you know, relatively new. You know, could say, you know, Z785, current stuff for Srixon, but I mean, G400, VR Pro Limited, MD4, you know, that's older stuff. So he's clearly a guy who, you know, once he finds something that is working, he's not going to tinker with it.
Yeah, this is a gamer setup. Like if you're on the first tee and you meet a guy and, you know, you've never played with him before and you look in his bag and he's got money. Something like this, no money.
Yep.
No money will no be money. Back because that's pure gamer bag right there.
Yeah, I'm with you there. He's definitely not a guy that I'd want to bet any money against.
And he just shot 59, so literally shouldn't bet money against him.
Exactly, just shot 59. Yeah, he's playing unbelievable. A guy only turned pro a couple years ago and he's already making a name for himself out on tour. But, you know, as always, you and I love the bag setup. I hope he doesn't change anytime soon. He's, I guess, other than the golf ball, I know he's got a deal with Titleist for just the ball, but everything else is free game. And my goodness, he has a white staff bag that's blank on both side panels. So, yeah, he's the epitome of a gear free agent at the moment.
Yeah, he's very much like Brooks Koepka. Very similar setups, similar bags. Yeah. Works out pretty well for Brooks. And Scotty just shot 59, so.
I don't think Brooks has 7 different brands in the bag.
Not quite 7. That's a big number.
All right, let's get into a guy who doesn't have 7 brands in the bag. He is represented by one brand in particular. That would be Ping, Bubba Watson, making a change last week. You know, Bubba, if you think about it, most of his success over his career has been with a Ping answer putter. You know, going back to his 2 Masters wins and getting all the way up to number 2 in the world. But before Bubba used an answer style putter, he was using a B60, perimeter weighted blade. You know, I would kind of dare say it was sort of that, like, almost like a gateway drug towards a mallet, little bit. Wider profile. Would you kind of agree with that statement?
Yeah, I would. It's almost like more of a mallet than a blade. It's got like a big profile too, in my opinion. When I like put down a B60 versus, you know, answer style or a Scotty Cameron or anything like that, I always kind of put it in that mallet category for me. But
maybe it's like a wide version, like a wider, the new kind of. You've seen brands come out with like a wide version of an answer style blade, mm-hmm. with a wider flange,
like a 1W,
a little bit more beef
from Odyssey. Yep. Yeah.
From Odyssey.
Yeah. It's just like that. Right. Yep. So it's kind of hard to like qualify it, but it's almost like its own category of putter. But I love this. So this. I love Bubba going back to square one. Cause I've seen him, on putting greens kind of fighting a little bit. Like he'll be testing a short putter and an arm lock. He'll be testing, you know, all sorts of different style putters. And sometimes you just got to go back to square one, you know, kind of get out of your own head, stop fighting, and go back to something that's worked in the past.
We've actually talked about this exact thing on the podcast before with the professor, you know, he mentioned just working with a couple of high profile names. And one of the things that he always asked those guys was, what's your favorite putter growing up? That's kind of an obvious question, because those, you know, the nostalgia that you have for a putter that you use maybe as a kid that you had success with, maybe that lends itself to having success if you're struggling, or at least gives you a little bit of a boost in confidence. And I think that's what the average golfer could probably learn from what Bubba's doing here, which is, if you're struggling with the flax stick, it's really easy to look at what's new, what's hot. But sometimes maybe it just makes sense to say, man, what did I have success with when I was a junior golfer? Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, 5-10 years ago when you were a single digit, now you're, you know, struggling to, you know, to break 85, and it's the putter that's the problem. Maybe you need to go back and look and see what you had success with in the past, instead of just trying to be, you know, so fixated on the new stuff.
That's why every time Rory goes back to a answer style putter, I always think he's going to putt lights out, because it's like, you know, this is what he used to putt with, this is what he was growing up with. And then he doesn't, and then he switches back to the mallet. It's always confusing to me with Rory, but, you know, besides the point, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But, you know, Rory is one of those guys where it's like, anytime he makes a change, we're always talking about it. So, no, I'm with you. I think you know, he had the most success with an answer style blade when he was playing that Cameron. So, it's kind of an obvious question to ask. Even when he was with Nike, when he was using the method, mm-hmm. you know, it's always kind of been like that for him. Although, you know, last year, not to go too far off the rails here on Rory, when we're supposed to be talking about Bubba, but
that's my fault. I'm sorry.
He putted well with the Spider. That was kind of surprising for me to kind of see him struggle a little bit this season, because it looked like he seemed to find something mm-hmm. with that mallet. So,
well, we actually just saw it with, not to keep going off the rails even farther, but
keep going.
Yeah.
Keep
going. I mean, let's go. We're already doing it. Dustin went back to his old trusty, all black Spider Tour putter. And obviously that's been working pretty well.
Austin said that's never going out of the bag now. It's stuck. It's a permanent fixture.
It looked like he was going to shoot 56 there for a while. Honestly, it was like,
I know.
He's just going to keep making birdies. He makes the turn in 27, then he birdies 10 and 11. It's like, all right, here we go. 49 watch it is.
Yeah, he was unconscious with the club that seems to be holding him back the most. You know, it's always been the putter for DJ. Mm-hmm. You know, that hasn't so much been the case with Bubba. You know, the putter is just kind of one part of the equation for him. But you know, this B60 is important, because this is the putter going back to when he was a kid. And first, you know, Bubba's used Ping stuff his entire life. This was the putter that he used. It was a B60. So there is a lot of history there. He had tried the PLD Hovland, that face balanced mallet that Victor Hovland uses with the double bend shaft, mm-hmm. just to try and see if it would work. You know, again, he's trying to find something, and he just said, look, I need some sort of toe hang here, you know. And this is something that we've seen within the industry, is, you know, guys trying out mallets or larger profiles with a bit of toe hang, just to try and get the blade properties in a larger profile. And that's kind of what Bubba did with this. He, you know, he opts for a 340 gram PLD version. The PLD is kind of these, you know, tour versions of, you know, putters that they can create for guys like Bubba. They're usually complete one-offs. But this one had a little bit less toe hang than a traditional answer, but it still kind of was able to move a little bit more like Bubba was hoping. And he put it in the bag. But, you know, again, it's one of those putters that he's had a lot of success with, a lot of memories with over the years. And it brings me to an important question, which is, Bubba adds a putter from his childhood back. What's one club that you've added back to the bag, you know, let's say within the last like 5 years, that was kind of more a nostalgia pick than anything else?
So we're talking about B60. This is pure coincidence, by the way, and people are going to think I'm making this story up.
I love this story.
Okay, so I was just back in New Jersey, and I didn't bring my clubs back. I wasn't really expecting to play golf, but, you know, the opportunity arose. And obviously I didn't have my clubs, so I had to go with a garage set, which is, you know, you go through all your old clubs, find something that you could you know, scrap together and go out to the course, have some fun. So I find my dad's old B60 ping putter. Now, I've never putted well in my life. We've had conversations between me and the professor. I think me and you have talked about it, trying to find a putter that works. And I've always kind of been like, well, I might as well just play what I want. You know, I play the Terillium usually because I never make any putts anyway. So I go out with my dad's B60 ping putter, and I'm absolutely lights out with this thing. I had the best putting round I've ever had in my life with this putter. I mean, I obviously wasn't fit or anything like that. I'd never even used it before. He had holed a bunch of putts on me in my childhood, so maybe something like that was involved, but I putted so well with it, and now I have my dad shipping it out to me. I'm going to put it in the bag out here. The Ping B60, pure coincidence that Bubba goes back the same week that I do. I had no idea that he even did that when I went out with the putter, but so I don't know if that counts as this part of
the counts.
But too funny. I was just fired up to putt well. I don't think I've ever made a putt outside of 4 feet in my life. And I was just pouring in 12, 25 footers all over the course. It was great. I'm still fired up about it. I can't wait to get that putter.
Sub 70 rounds in your future. A lot of money coming your way.
I hope so. I hope so, man. How about you?
I think for me, you know, and this goes against everything we've talked about on this podcast,
mm-hmm.
especially with our discussions about Justin Thomas and how he kind of changes out his wedges. Usually will change out the 60 on a more frequent basis to keep the grooves fresh.
Mm-hmm.
I have an old Vokey 200 series oil can.
Ooh.
You know, it's just kind of a beater lob wedge that I've had. I mean, it was my gamer lob wedge for years. When I was a kid, I just can't get rid of it. And every once in a while, I'll just like throw it back in the bag, go around with it. Grooves are shot. I know it, but it's kind of like I've worn it out just how I would want a wedge. And I almost think I should probably just hand that wedge off the next time I have a set of wedges made and just say, can you give it this kind of grind? Because again, I've worn that sole out just how I like it. It fits like a worn-in baseball glove.
Mm-hmm.
So I do throw it in from time to time. I feel like I need somebody to like slap my hand and call me an idiot each time that I do it. But it's so cool. It's really worn. I got to post a picture on our social media page of it. But it's definitely a keeper. I don't know if I'm gonna get rid of it until the face is completely worn down, but it's getting close.
I mean, there's something to that, especially with wedges. I mean, you go back in like Tiger's career, he started with the 588 Cleveland and he's been basically matching that design ever since. Like he just continues to match the grind. So it's like, once you find that right grind, you really should send it off and, you know, get it matched as much as possible.
Yeah.
And maybe some fresh grooves will help, or maybe you got to go see McCord's groove guy and just sharpen those grooves up and just keep that wedge in the bag.
I'd say that it'd probably stay fresh if I go to McCord's groove guy. all right. So we're going from one ping staffer to a new ping club that I'm pretty sure Mr. Watson's going to be having in the bag soon enough. Ping has a new driver, Tursky. The G425, it landed on the USGA conforming list. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so there's three new heads, and they're kind of changing up the names a little bit. They're going with, they got rid of the Plus. They went with the G410 Plus last year, and now they're going with the G425 Max, which is pretty interesting.
And then that is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up.
And then they're filling out the rest with the standard LST and SFT that they've had in their families for years now. What can you draw from calling it the Max instead of the Plus? Is that a throwback to the G400 Max that sold really well and people still have in the bag? I'm assuming that's why they did it, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most logical reason. I honestly wonder if the Plus confused people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a standard head. It wasn't you know, a Max product, but the Plus to me kind of implies like more. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if people were maybe confused by the fact that there was a plus product, but it was a standard head. I don't know. That's just kind of me, you know, thinking, you know, a little bit outside the box there. But I think you're probably a little bit more in line with what it is. You know, the Max was a very popular product for them. It was popular on tour. It was popular in retail shops. It makes sense to bring it back with the 425. Is there anything else other than the naming that, I mean, here's the thing with the US Shaken formulas for people that don't frequent it as much as we do. This isn't an area where we can see the golf club from all different angles. We're getting a shot of the sole, and by the way, it's black and white. So we can't even really give you a good idea of what the color scheme is or the technology. But was there anything else you could kind of glean from the details that they posted on the conforming list?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it is a black and white photo, and I love seeing the color schemes. That's like, you know, I'm into that part of it. But yeah, you can definitely tell like where the tungsten is placed. You know, you can kind of tell what kind of driver we're looking at. Is it high spin, low spin? Is it adjustable? You can tell on two of the driver heads. They have draw and fade written on the sole, so you know it's going to be CG adjustable. What else can you tell from it? You can kind of tell like just the shaping, the size, whether it's going to be a slightly smaller head that's a little fade biased, that's going to be the tour product, maybe 455 cc's, 445 cc's, something like that. You could tell when the head's elongated, that'll be the high MOI product. I mean, you just look at the names from recent Ping families and you kind of tell where we're going. You know, LST, yeah. Max, and SFT. You know there's going to be a draw bias, a fade bias, a low spin, and a high MOI.
Well, I mean, I think we both know that the one thing Ping does better than I would probably say almost anybody else within the OEM space is forgiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, their products are incredibly forgiving year in, year out, whenever they bring a new product to market. And, you know, I think that's one thing that we can be certain these products have is more forgiveness than the previous generation. They've probably found a way to increase the forgiveness. I will give you guys out there listening a little bit of inside baseball on this. There's a reason why this product came out on the USGA conforming list. Do you know why?
Well, I'm assuming you're about to tell me. Well, let's get it.
So clubs come out on the conforming list because they're headed to tour. Mm-hmm. So the logical reason is, okay, they come out because they're putting them out on the PGA Tour. But I can tell you that's not the case.
Not the PGA Tour.
No. The JLPGA, the Japan LPGA Golf Tour, that's where they're releasing this product. Mm-hmm. So
why are they doing that, do you think?
I think just a lot of it has to do with, you know, if you look at the way that things are going right now with COVID, unfortunately, mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably a better chance that you're going to see golf product coming out maybe over in Asia before other areas. I have heard that this new G425 is not going to be coming out until the beginning of 2021. Which is, you know, it's different from the way that we've seen products in the past come to North America. So this is, you know, it's a kind of a different shift away from the normal release schedule. And I think that there's just probably a better opportunity for them to capitalize and drop it over there where, you know, they you know, might get more product early on than we do see over here in North America. So
you think that's a supply thing? Because we did just see a Golf Data Tech report come out that says, you know, equipment sales are just absolutely booming in the US. Maybe it's just they can't get all that supply over here.
I think a lot of it just has to do with that. You're exactly right. Just trying to get supply. Not everybody uses products that are made over in Asia to mm-hmm. you know, to bring their component parts over here to finish the clubs. But I know Callaway's got a facility over in Mexico. And so it's probably a little bit easier for them to get product up than it was, especially when COVID was raging. But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what we have to just realize is that things are different with this release and that North America is going to be a little bit staggered this year is what I'm hearing. So you know, probably an early 2021 release instead of getting it, you know, later in 2020, like we've seen from previous Ping products. And I don't think Ping's the only one that's dealing with this. I know for a fact that there are others that are also trying to figure out, you know, processes for getting product over from Asia. So, yeah, it's different, but JLPGA, you know, we saw with TaylorMade, they released their new, the P7MBs.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
Over in Europe,
a lot of the companies are releasing, you know, kind of globally and on tours that you wouldn't necessarily expect, which I like to see.
Well, and it was a women's tour event over in Europe. So, you know, it's not, you know, we're not seeing product showing up first time out on the PGA Tour like we normally do. I kind of love it. I like things being shaken up just a little bit, just because we get so used to the cadences and the way things are done and where they're released. Throwing me a curveball, I know, it just kind of keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, you got to be on the JLPGA Getty Images now, not just PGA Tour.
I am. I'm probably the only one searching for it at this point. if photos show up, we'll be sure to post some of that are non-black and white.
Yeah, I need to see this color scheme. Yeah, I'm always interested in that.
We have to see it, and I'm sure it's going to surface here.
You got a guess?
Not too distant future.
Red, blue.
I don't know. They've done red. I think they might do a different color. I'm thinking maybe something more subdued. Maybe like silver and black. I don't know. It's tough to tell with that black and white. But it doesn't look like there's a lot of. Doesn't look like there's a lot of spots for color. I don't know.
Ping Rapture, it's kind of dark in there. Ping Rapture, that was like green, right?
Green. I was gonna say that was green.
That's maybe what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping they go back to black and green.
That'd be a cool color scheme. I think something that pops. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yep. Agreed.
All right. So with that, let's get into this week's mailbag. Eric Seatvet asks, his question has to do with testing and practicing when you can't find a practice area that has targets that are under 100 yards. Mm-hmm. Are there ways to set up testing and practice areas that we can recommend or that he can recommend to his club? This is a great question because I think, you know, at least for me, I think more people should be doing wedge testing. Seems really easy to go out and just pull out a set of fresh wedges from, you know, off the rack and throw them in the bag. But this is, you know, look, you're not going to get your club probably to set up a testing area. So I think the best way to do it is probably, in my opinion, start from like 50 yards and in, because I feel like that's where you're going to be able to really see the performance of a wedge and how it's going to react. And, you know, take a 56, even a 52, and go out there maybe 50, maybe even 60 yards, hit some shots, little, you know, half, three-quarter shots, hit some from the rough. If you've got an area around your practice green, assuming that you've got a little a short game practice area, go and work on those shots, see how the ball reacts from the rough, see how it reacts from the short grass, but do it on shots that aren't full swings, because again, you're not going to be hitting a lob wedge, even really a 56, very often with a full swing. So it's way more important in my eyes to get around those shorter distances and see how it reacts and work in from there. Go 50, 60, work in, and then start working around the green, hitting little bump and runs, you know, hit a flop shot, really work those wedges through to see how they react, especially for the shots that are your go-tos. Don't just, I mean, if a flop shot's not something that you normally hit, probably not worth it to try it during testing, but yeah, start 50, 60 and work your way in, and I think you'll be good. Hopefully your short game practice area has an area to hit from the rough, because that's kind of one of those litmus tests. Maybe even go out on a dewy morning, try and hit some. There are plenty of ways to use your current practice setup to test wedges. What do you think, man?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's my favorite solution. I mean, I don't know his setup, but I assume he doesn't have like a great short game area, or he wouldn't be asking the question. So I would say, you know, try to play by yourself like really early in the morning or late at night, where there's no one behind you, there's no pressure, you're playing by yourself, and you can kind of just throw a bunch of balls around the green, see how they react, see what you like, hit some from the fairway, hit a full shot or two, compare it to your other wedge, and then go to the second hole, do the same thing again, and just, you know, keep doing it until you're comfortable either, okay, this is the right wedge for me, or no, this is out. I like my old wedge better. I got to find something more like that. And make sure you're using balls that, like, you would actually play with. Don't take, you know, the really rock hard range balls or just some busted up balls. Like, use the balls that you would actually use to see how the ball would react in game time. That's the best advice I got right there.
But my college coach. That's a testing hack. That's a testing hack.
Yeah, going out on the golf course.
That is a testing hack. Yeah, I mean, you may be right. The guy doesn't have, you know, a short game area with greens that are similar to what you're going to find out on the golf course. And so that may be his best option. Go out early in the morning before play starts, you know, firing up, or go out late in the day, which I think is almost even better, and just work around the greens at your local course. That's a great idea.
My other hack is to get some cones, and this might be more of like a practice feel thing than necessarily a testing thing, but I always found it to be pretty helpful. And, you know, you just set up cones like 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 yards, and you just keep trying to pepper each of those cones going back and forth up the ladder, down the ladder, and you kind of get a really good feel for how you're hitting that wedge, how it reacts, and it also helps with feel a lot too. So, fun tip there.
I see a testing hacks story in our future on the website.
I think I just wrote it basically. Now I just got to transcribe it. Yeah, look out on golf.com for that one coming soon.
Hey, definitely. We appreciate the question, Eric. And with that, let's get into this week's interview. With Phil's win in his first Champions Tour start, there's nobody better to talk about his gear with than Callaway Senior Club Performance Analyst Garrett Pond. Garrett is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to Phil's gear. Let's get into it.
All right, Garrett Pond, welcome to the Fully Equipped Podcast. I appreciate you coming on last minute, but it's special because Phil Mickelson just finished up winning his first Champions Tour event by 4 shots. How about that? What do you think about that?
Yeah, hey Andrew, thanks for having me. And yeah, you're right. That's quite a debut for the rookie on the tour there for Phil. And we're sure happy to see him have some success out there right out of the gate.
Absolutely. So I know you as Phil's equipment guy, but how would you describe your relationship with him through the years for people who might not know exactly who you are?
Yeah, I guess, you know, you could call me his guy in the way of clubs. It's been about 10, 11 years now that I've been working on his clubs. Maybe not exclusively. I know he'll do some stuff on the trailer at some of the events, but primarily if he, you know, needs to modify clubs, if he needs anything new built, that, you know, he usually comes to me for that. And that's not uncommon for guys out there on tour to kind of build up a history with the same person working on their equipment. But he's also become a friend over the years as well. I've played some golf with him, and, you know, we get together here at the test center often and have a good laugh and try and accomplish some things in the way of getting his clubs dialed in as well.
That's pretty cool. You get to play a bunch with Phil. I think that's on a lot of people's bucket list in their lives. What's that experience like playing with him?
Well, you know, the first time was a number of years ago, and, you know, I was a fan of his a lot longer, you know, prior to me, you know, working with him. So I was nervous. I think anyone that's a golf fan, they play with, you know, a high level player like that, probably get a little bit jitters, and it doesn't help when he's jabbing at you too, you know, with some smack talk. But eventually you kind of settle down a little bit and you realize it's just golf, and he's trying to beat you. Even though this is just a fun game, he wants to get in your head so that he's got a better chance to win. So now that I've kind of familiarized myself a little bit with that, I know what to expect, and I can kind of play, you know, the game that I'm capable of playing, which is kind of mediocre at best.
Do you you barter for more strokes from him?
There's definitely negotiation on the first tee there, but I will say this: he wants to have to play good to beat you, which I think's cool. So he'll give you strokes to where you feel comfortable teeing up, you know, based on based on your own game. And, you know, he's got to go out there and do some good things if he wants to win at the end of the day.
I respect that a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
As someone who's, you know, worked so closely with Phil and become his friend, have you guys talked about the Champions Tour, and did you kind of see this early dominance coming?
I think we've maybe, you know, I've asked him at some point in the past if he's going to play some of those events, and I don't know if he gave me like a straight answer, like he's looking forward to getting out there, or or he's, you know, wanting to avoid it at all costs either. It hadn't come up a ton, but I know he likes to do a certain preparation leading into a major, and, as you know, we're coming up to the U.S. Open pretty soon. This is kind of the best opportunity for him to do his preparation, and, you know, that consists of competitive rounds. So it kind of worked out well for his schedule, I guess, more than anything.
If he never gets it done playing the regular U.S. Open in terms of recording a win, but he wins the U.S. Senior Open, is he going to count that as a career Grand Slam or what?
That's a good question. I'm sure people could debate about that. I don't know. That's a good question. I would want to say no, but I guess just like we say about Phil a lot of times, one thing you know about him is you never do know with him. So he might count it. He might not. I'm not sure.
Right, right. He's an interesting.
That's still a pretty good achievement if he's able to pull that off, no matter how he views that in his mind, that win.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, he's an interesting guy, and he's hilarious for many reasons, but more specifically for this equipment show, he's a big equipment guy. Is he the type of golfer that likes to sponge up information about the tech and get real geeky like a Bryson, or is he more looking to experiment with things and try to find like the right feels?
I wouldn't say he's, you know, looking at it the same way Bryson is. We've spent a little time here with Bryson in his amateur days, and I know he's kind of on a different level, the way he thinks about his equipment and adding science to it and everything. Still certainly very meticulous with his equipment. I think he's more looking through with some feel rather than some science applied to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, what does a fitting session look like with Phil? Is it like a 10-hour long grind session, or you kind of get in and get out? He knows what he wants to change.
It's funny you say that. It couldn't be more the opposite of that. So he's a local guy here. You know, he lives in Rancho Santa Fe, which is 20 minutes from us in Carlsbad. And he likes to do a lot of his testing on the golf course. So we kind of have an idea based on all the clubs we've built in the past and what he's like, what he's played well with, and what we know about, you know, our new clubs each and every year. We kind of know what to set the loft to, what to set the lie angles to, what he wants to try for length and swing weights and shaft weights and all that. So we kind of build him a lot of stuff, and then that'll often mean, you know, we'll build him a set of Apex Pro irons, we'll build them a set of Apex Muscleback irons to the same spec, and he'll take them both and start doing some trial on the course with them. Sometimes he'll do a little bit of testing here at the test center, but not a ton. It's mostly kind of, okay, here's the clubs, let me go play with them. I'm going to give you some feedback, and based on that feedback, we're gonna make some adjustments to it, or we're going to eliminate something as an option. Or we're going to kind of learn something from the feedback he gives us, and then, you know, come up with a new solution.
Yeah, keep going.
A lot of players, you know, they're coming to us from Carlsbad, and they might be here for 2 days from Florida, from Texas, or something like that. So they are spending 10 hours with us here over the course of that day or two. And really kind of making sure they get as much done here in Carlsbad at the test center while they're in town. So it's a little bit unique from the sense that Phil could still could drop in and bend the lie angle of a club a half degree and then go play with it and then come back the next day and say it needs to be bent another half degree or, you know, something different.
And that's mostly based on his feel, not by like TrackMan. He just goes out in the course and then he comes back. He's like, yeah, I need half a degree of change.
It's a combination of the two. Yeah, but lie angle, he'll often use a combination of his feel. He'll work with his coach, Andrew Getson, on that a little bit. He's worked with Dave Pels in the past, a system for testing irons where it's a kind of a system of hitting different types of shots. And if the heel that Phil is putting into the swing does not match up with how the ball is flying, we'll start adjusting the club until the shot matches what it feels like it's supposed to do, if that makes sense. So we're more here just to kind of service Phil's requests with his equipment rather than totally assess his game and then tell him what he should be doing with his equipment.
I gotcha. And in recent years, especially on social media, he's talking about hitting bombs and chasing distance and all sorts of stuff like that. Has he made any drastic changes specifically to gain more distance, like in terms of loft or certain shafts or shaft length?
He's lengthened the shaft of the driver longer than he's had in years past. He's playing 46 inches with his driver now. And he went through a process of maybe not hitting as many fairways as he wanted. So trying a shorter shaft, seeing if that, gained some accuracy or improved his fairway statistics. And I think any potential benefit on control was overwhelmed by the fact that the shorter shaft, he lost distance. And I can recall one conversation with him about carry distance on the PGA Tour. And I don't know if this is like a widely known stat or if this is something that he's kind of kept track of, but he said the average carry distance, carry the fairway bunkers on the PGA Tour is 310 yards. And with the longer shaft, he's got the ability to carry that 310 yard number. With the shorter shaft, he doesn't. So in his mind, the fairway is much wider past the bunker rather than trying to go between the bunkers.
Wow, that's really interesting. What do you know where he finds like stats like that? Does he work with a statistician, or is that like something that you guys go to him and tell him? Like, where does he find that number from?
He mentioned that to me, and I wish I had a little more info on where that came from, but that's just one of the things that he's mentioned to me in the past. And it could just be that he's been on tour so long and he's kept records of all these things over the years that he kind of knows what the typical carry is that makes the fairway wide enough after that 310 number.
I wish I could hit it more than 310.
Yeah, it takes about I know you got some speed, man, but it takes about 180 miles an hour ball speed with pretty efficient launch and spin, higher launch, lower spin, to get a carry in the 310 number, unless there's some outside factors like wind, heat, humidity, all the things that can affect distance, elevation, so on and so forth.
I feel like he's always been a pretty high launching guy. Is that true? Like, what are the things that he works on in terms of trying to gain more distance? Is he trying to knock spin down and launch it high, or how does he go about it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's hitting up on the ball 4 or 5 degrees, a little bit from the inside. Fairly low lofted driver, and when you kind of combine all those things together, that you'll give yourself a pretty good chance to launch it high. He likes it in the 14, 15 degree window, and then spin it low. He likes his straighter shots to spin like 2300, 2400, and if he's trying to turn it over, get it down to 2100, and if it's a little bit, he likes the spin to stay in the upper 2000s so that he doesn't lose too much distance.
And
that's a good rule of thumb for anyone, that's got some pretty good speed that likes to hit all three shot shape, you know, draws fades and straight. You want your draws to retain enough spin to not lose carry, and you want your fades to stay low enough on spin to not lose the chance of rolling out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And he has a Maverick Sub-Zero 9-degree driver, I believe, in the bag right now. Does he do anything custom to that head in terms of, like, hot melt changing the CG location?
No. No hot melt in the driver this year. It's basically empty, and he's got the heaviest screw available, which is 14 grams that we make for those drivers now, in the front, and then a 2-gram screw in the back, and that's essentially the setting that gives that head the best chance to lower the back spin.
Okay.
And he plays it in the stated or the standard loft setting too, and like a lot of his clubs, he plays the driver upright, which for us at Callaway, that's the D setting on our hosel.
I gotcha. I got to ask about the wedges too. You know, Phil's known for wedges, and I know he's played custom grinds throughout his career. What does he look for in terms of his grind? Like, is there any miss that he's guarding against?
Well, it's imperative that he's able to hit a flop shot with that club and not have the club bounce into the ball too much. But it also is a club that's got to be able to hit a real high shot out of a bunker. And sometimes those two requirements conflict with one another. So if you want to hit a flop shot, you're often looking for very low bounce and a narrow sole, so when the face is open, you can slide the leading edge under the ball. And when you're trying to hit it out of a bunker, you tend to want a little more bounce or a little more width on the sole so that it displaces more sand and pushes sand up into the ball so that the ball, you know, you get a higher, softer shot. So the grind that he's got now is a fairly low bounce. And we grind it to where it's a little lower bounce than his PM grind wedge starts. Yet it's a fairly wide sole. So it's kind of got a good combination for him to where he can still open the face and keep the leading edge low, but also hit down into the sand. And he hits down fairly steep compared to a lot of elite players and pros in a bunker shot. So having that wide sole is like critical for his bunker game.
For sure. And he always keeps some lead tape on the back of it there. I always call Phil the king of lead tape. Is that something he puts on his clubs himself, or is that you kind of coaching him along?
He does that all himself, and sometimes it'll be on any club in the bag, including the putter. I don't know if you've seen some of his putters up close, but he'll start putting lead tape all over those clubs.
Yeah, recently I saw some photos of lead tape like wrapped around the hosel of his putter. That was a pretty interesting location for that, I thought. Never really seen that before.
Yeah, there's another putter, forget the name of the brand, but kind of a boutique putter company that has like a gigantic hosel on the putter, and then otherwise it's kind of a real traditional blade style. And he rolled a couple putts with that putter, I think, at one of the clubs he plays at here in San Diego. And I asked him what he liked about it, and he said that he liked how heavy the head felt. But because all the weight was in the hosel, he felt like the ball didn't shoot off the face really fast, which for him is always something that's important in his putter. It's for the ball not to jump off the face. That's why he likes a really soft insert on his putter. So he started tinkering with putting weight on the shaft, you know, down by the hosel there, using lead tape, and he gets the sense that with a heavier head, he's got a little bit more control, but because the weight's not on the head itself, the ball comes off at a speed that he wants to see it come off, which is a little bit slower.
Yeah, makes sense. He was bouncing around between like a few different putters there for a while, but it seems like he's going to stick with this one for a while, huh?
Yeah, he's been doing a lot of testing, not with us here, but he's been working with an instructor, I think, out at the Grand in Del Mar, who's kind of known as a bit of a putter specialist. He's been working with him a lot, looking at launch, looking at spin, looking at the acceleration through the ball, you know, all the things that Quintec system can measure, all the things that Sam system can measure. And he's leaned on the data that he's been able to collect from those systems pretty heavily to try and dial in the lie angle of his putters and dial in the loft angles. And it seems like that's the one he keeps going back to, getting the best numbers in the practice sessions. And seems like he rolls that one pretty good in competition too, compared to any of the other putters you might see. Is that real old school 8802 style with the white hot XG insert that he had today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's always loved that 8802 shape. So
yeah, I think he had that, you know, in his bag, that head shape, like in his PGA Tour debut, you know, going back into the early 90s.
Yeah, it's crazy. Just gotta always go back to Old Faithful, it seems, with the putter, you know.
And he's certainly willing to make a change to anything that shows like there's a potential for improvement there. He's tried our high MOI putters. He's tried the perimeter weight putters. He's tried the new insert. He's tried the stroke bob shaft technology, and he always just has kind of gravitated back to that putter he used today.
Yeah, speaking of Phil, like basically being willing to try anything, you know, there's some crazy stories about Phil when it comes to his equipment. You know, you got the Frankenwood and playing two drivers, playing no drivers. What's like the one story that sticks out to you that people may not know? Not one of like the super popular stories about Phil, but you know, something that went a little bit more under the radar.
Oh gosh. Maybe it's not as under the radar now. But for the whole season this year, he's been playing a set of irons that, you would typically see in the silver flight of a country club member guest tournament, you know, at the high, that being the Epic Forged Irons. That's, mm-hmm. that's a club you would find in a 10 to 20 handicappers bag usually. And he's been using those. And so he's just having the most wonderful experience hitting those irons. He hits them really, really high, hits them really, really straight. He likes the spin rates that he gets with them. So it's not common to see, you know, a tour player use, especially a tour player that might go down as one of the best iron, long iron or mid iron players in the history of the game, when it's all said and done, to use a set that you'd hand a 16 handicapper and that they'd love too.
What was like that initial experience of him even hitting those irons? Was he super skeptical at first?
No, he requested them. So, it's not uncommon for us to make just about every club in our line for him. So if you think about like our hybrids, we make Maverick standard hybrids. We make Maverick pro hybrids. You'd think we only would hand a tour player the Maverick pro hybrid, because that's kind of, they're geared towards the better player, but we make them the pro hybrid. We make them the standard hybrid, and he'll often, hit the standard style clubs really well, just because they tend to have the CG bias that he tends to hit really straight, which tends to be a little more draw bias rather than fade bias. And they tend to be more upright with the lie angles, which he tends to play all of his clubs a little more upright than some tour, well, than the average tour player does, I should say. So he'll want to try irons like the Epic Forged. And it started with making a 4, 5, and 6 iron, which kind of makes sense. A lot of pros will want to try a easier to launch or a better distance iron in their longer clubs, and then they'll stick with the pro style clubs in the mid and short iron. And a lot of people say, well, there's no way he's hitting that, and they'll look at the specs of the loft and everything. But we don't make the stock loft for him. We bend those clubs to the specs that that he always plays. So that means, you know, taking the 4-iron in that set, which he's always played at 21 degrees, you got to take that and bend it about 3 degrees weak to get to his spec. And then, you know, do that through the whole set. Take the Epic forge and bend them to hit the loft and lie that he always plays, regardless of if it's that game improvement iron or if it was a muffle back, you know, iron with the same number on it. So he started with the 4, 5, and 6 and said, I'm hitting it so good with these 4, 5, and 6. Make me the rest of the set. So we did that. And that was kind of in the off season, you know, when there's not a lot of rough in San Diego and he's not traveling a lot. So he's not having the opportunity to try and hit those clubs from PGA Tour rough into the green. So for me, that was the real question, whether or not those would stick around in his bag after he had to try and hit, you know, the bigger headed clubs out of the rough. But it seems like he's able to hit those exactly the way he wants to hit out of the rough. And throughout the course of the year, he's kind of gravitated towards a set makeup that he's really liked. So right now he stops at the 6-iron, although he did try all the way up to 9-iron and pitching wedge in those Epic boards. In fact, I think he played those at Pebble Beach, if I'm not mistaken, all the way through the pitching wedge. But anyway, over time, he's kind of dialed the set into 4, 5, and 6, Epic Forge, 8, 9, and pitching wedge in the Apex Muscleback. And then the 7-iron's kind of in a state of flux. Sometimes it's the Epic Forge, sometimes it's the Apex Pro, sometimes it's the Muscleback. I believe this week he had the Apex Pro. So I don't know, maybe it's maybe he's such a good ambassador for our company that he wants every product line to be able to have a win advertisement tomorrow, whether it's Epic, Apex, Maverick, you name it. We can say it's a win ad for all of them.
Yeah, no matter what Callaway iron you buy, it's the one that Phil played.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
But I think that is interesting for our listeners. You know, sometimes it's hard to like learn something from what the pros are playing because it's like so different than what you're playing. But with Phil, you know, he's open to just try anything. And I think it's important for people to have an open mind when they go into a fitting or, you know, they're looking to buy a new set. It's like, you know, you don't have to stay in one wheelhouse. You can go and experiment and figure out what's best for your game.
Yeah, and I've thought this for a long time as a club fitter, and he's a good example of this with the way his irons are set right now. I think of irons rather than as a set of them. I think of them as like an a la carte club within a bag of 14 gloves. So if you like a certain short iron, figure out where you stop liking that iron, and then figure out why you start not liking it. Is it a club? Does the club start to get too hard to hit? Does the club produce a trajectory that's not high enough? Is it too hard to hit straight? Something like that. And then figure out what you need to put in your bag to sort of feel like it's the right club. And then just keep going through that same process down in the bag. That you don't have to have the same 6 and 7 iron that you have in the 5 and 4 iron. And I think that's starting to become a little bit more widely thought of as a way to put your set of irons together is like the ultimate combo set.
I'm so happy you said that. That's such great advice for people trying to put together a set of irons, especially these days, you know, with like companies like Callaway who are making it so easy to make combo sets with their loft packages.
Yeah. And if you wanted to like totally go off the grid, sort of like Phil did, where you're combining all sorts of different sets of clubs together, the main thing you want to be cognitive of is loft. So, you know, a Epic Flash or Epic Forge, rather, 4-iron off the rack, like 18 degrees. And a Apex Pro 4-iron is like 20. So it's a difference there. So you just want to know what all the lofts start at, and then figure out where they need to finish by the time it's the right loft for your iron. And then you want to be aware of some of the things that are affected as a trade-off when you change the loft. So, like, you're adding loft to a club, there's going to be more bounce on it. It goes through the turf a little bit different. You're strengthening an iron to sort of fit the loft gapping appropriately. That decreases the bounce, and that's going to have an influence on how the club goes through the turf. And then offset will start to change as you start bending lofts on an iron. So in Phil's case, back to that Epic Forged iron, he's very steep with his long iron. So taking those and bending them weak gave him a little bit more bounce on the irons, and they go through the turf in a way that he thinks this is perfect for him with the extra bounce. And then the reason to bend the loft is not necessarily to give him a bounce that he likes, to produce the spin rate and the trajectory and distance that he wants those clubs to go. So it also reduces the offset. So he kind of gets a club, even though it's big and oversized, it's got a bounce that he wants on there. It's got an offset that sort of blends nicely to a pro style smaller head, and then of course the launch and spin and ease of use or easy to hit straight aspect of it. He's got a lot of things kind of working together to make that club make sense for him.
Mm-hmm. So much you can learn from Phil and his setup. I got one last question for you, and you might not even know sure. the answer. I'm not sure, but I'm curious, so I want to know. Have you ever seen Phil's like club collection, like his garage or his basement, and like how many clubs does he have?
I have actually. It's pretty impressive. He's got a room attached to his garage, and it's a pretty good collection of clubs. And I think when I was there, I asked him, what's the oldest driver you've got in here that you won a golf tournament on the PGA Tour with?
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to look at, because it almost looked like so small, such a tiny head. The shaft didn't look like there was any tech to it, that it was like, I can't believe how much different clubs are today from, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, so that would have been 22, 25 years, something like that, after he won with it on the tour. It just blew me away how tiny drivers were not too long ago. But yeah, it's a pretty good collection.
Yeah, those driver heads from the 90s, it's like we have one laying around the office here, and you put it up to a golf ball, it's like barely even wider than a golf ball. It's like,
yeah,
how did we used to even do this?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. It made the golf ball look like a beach ball. You put it down next to a ball.
Right, that's exactly right. Well, Garrett, you know, congratulations on Phil getting his first Champions Tour win in quite the fashion, quite the Phil fashion. Typical Phil,
yeah, no doubt,
goes out there and blows the field out.
Thanks a lot, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the last one he gets out there too. So. It'll be fun to see him kind of split time while he's still competitive on the PGA Tour, and then, schedule permitting, seeing him pick and choose some of those champions events to keep his game sharp as well and compete with those players.
Absolutely. Next time he makes a big equipment change, I'm going to be in your ear.
Happy to fill you in on the details when I can.
All right, cool. Thank you so much for joining the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, Garrett. And big thanks to Garrett Pond for a great interview today. For more gear news, hit us up on Instagram @FullyEquippedGolf or on Twitter @Fully_Equipped. And we will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.